Century Rain by Alistair Reynolds. Narrated by John Lee. Copyright 2004 by Alistair Reynolds. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Alistair Reynolds and United Agents and was produced in the year 2010 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. 1. The river flowing sluggishly under Pont de la Concorde was flat and grey, like worn-out linoleum. It was October, and the authorities were having one of their periodic crackdowns on contraband. They had set up their customary lightning checkpoint at the far end of the bridge, backing traffic all the way across to the right bank.
"One thing I've never got straight," Christine said. "Are we musicians supplementing our income with a little detective work on the side, or is it the other way around?"
Floyd glanced into the rearview mirror.
"Which way round would you like it to be?"
"I think I'd like it best if I had the kind of income that didn't need supplementing.
We were doing all right until recently."
"Until recently, we were a trio. Before that, a quartet. Perhaps it's just me, but I'm beginning to detect a trend."
Floyd slipped the Mathis into gear and eased forward as the line advanced.
"All we have to do is hold the fort together until she returns."
"That isn't going to happen," Christine said. "She left for good when she got on that train. You keeping a seat free for her in the front of the car isn't going to change things."
"It's her seat."
"She's gone,"
Christine sighed.
"That's the trouble with recognizing talent. Sooner or later, someone else recognizes it as well."
The big Frenchman rummaged in his jacket pocket.
"Here, show the nice man my papers."
Floyd took the yellowing documents and placed them next to his own on the dashboard. When they reached the checkpoint, the guard flicked through Floyd's papers and handed them back wordlessly. He thumbed through Costine's, then leaned down until he had a good view into the back of the Mathis.
"On business, monsieur?"
"I wish,"
Costine said quietly.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"It means we were looking for work," Floyd said amiably. "Unfortunately, we didn't find any."
"What kind of work?"
"Music," Floyd said, gesturing around the car.
"Hence the instruments."
The guard jabbed the muzzle of his stamped metal machine gun towards the soft fabric case of the double bass.
"You could get a lot of cigarettes into that. Pull your vehicle over to the inspection area."
Floyd slipped the old Mathis back into gear and crunched it forward, steering into a bay where the guards performed more detailed searches. To one side was a striped wooden cabin where the guards amused themselves with cards and cheap pornography. A low stone wall overlooked a narrow pebbled quay. An empty chair stood by the wall next to a large trestle table covered with a cloth.
"Say as little as possible," Floyd said to Christine.
As the guard with the machine gun returned to his post, another from the inspection area knocked on the roof of the car.
"Bring it out, place it on the table."
Floyd and Christine worked the case from the rear of the Mathis. It was cumbersome, rather than heavy, and had already accumulated enough scuffs and scratches that a few more wouldn't matter.
"You want me to open it?" Christine asked. "Of course," the second guard said. "And remove the instrument, please."
Christine did as he was told, setting the double bass down gently. There was just enough room for it on the table next to the empty case.
"There," he said. "You're welcome to examine the case if you think I have the ingenuity to hide something in it other than the instrument."
"It's not the case I'm concerned about," the guard said.
He motioned to one of his colleagues, who was sitting on a folding chair next to the striped cabin. The man put down his newspaper and picked up a wooden toolkit, an inspector of some kind, clearly.
"I've seen these two before,"
the guard continued.
"They're back and forth across the river like it's going out of fashion. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?"
The inspector narrowed his eyes at Christine.
"I know this one," he said. "Used to be a policeman, didn't you? Some big cheese at Central Headquarters?" "I felt a change of career would do me good."
Floyd took a fresh toothpick from his shirt pocket, inserted it into his mouth and bit down. The sharp end dug into his mouth, drawing blood.
"Quite a calm down, isn't it? From high-profile police work to this," the inspector persisted, setting his toolkit down.
"If you say so," Christine replied.
The inspector picked up the double bass, shaking it with a look of deep concentration on his face
before returning it to the table. "Nothing rattling around," he said, reaching for his toolkit. "Still, they might have taped something to the inside. We'll have to take this boy apart." Floyd saw Christine draw in a sharp breath and place his hands protectively on the double bass. "You can't take it apart," Christine said incredulously. "It's an instrument. It doesn't come apart." "In my experience," the inspector said, "everything comes apart in the end." "Easy," Floyd said. "Let them have it. It's just a piece of wood." "Listen to your friend," the guard suggested. "He talks good sense, especially for an American." "Take your hands from the instrument, please," the inspector said. Christine wasn't going to do it. Floyd couldn't blame him, not really. The double bass was the most expensive item Floyd owned, including the Mathis ME4. Short of another investigation dropping into their laps, it was also about the only thing standing between them and penury. "Let go," Floyd mouthed. "Not worth it." The inspector and Christine began to struggle over the instrument. Drawn by the commotion, the guard with the machine gun, who had stopped them originally, left his post and began to saunter over to the action. The double bass was now off the table, and the two men were yanking it backwards and forwards violently. The guard with the gun slipped off its safety catch. The struggle intensified, Floyd fearing that the double bass was about to snap in two as the men wrestled with it. Then Christine's opponent gained the upper hand and pulled the instrument out of Christine's grasp. For a moment, the inspector froze, and then, in a single fluid movement, threw the double bass over the low wall on the other side of the examination table. Time dragged. It seemed an eternity before Floyd heard the awful splintering as the double bass hit the cobbled dock below. Christine sagged back into the chair next to the examination table. Floyd spat out his toothpick, grinding it underfoot like a spent cigarette. He walked slowly to the wall and peered down to inspect the damage. It was 10-12 meters to the cobbled key. The bass's neck was broken in two, the body smashed into myriad jagged pieces radiating away from the point of impact. A scuffing of booted feet drew Floyd's attention to his right. The second guard was on his way down to the key, descending a stone staircase jutting out from the wall. Hearing a moaning sound to his left, Floyd glanced over to see Christine looking over the parapet. His eyes were wide and white as eggs, his pupils shrunken to shocked dots. Eventually, his moaning formed into coherent sounds.
"No, no, no!"
"It's done," Floyd said, "and the sooner we get out of here, the better off we'll be."
"You destroyed history!" Christine shouted at the inspector. "That was Soudieu's double bass. Django Reinhardt touched that wood."
Floyd clamped a hand over his friend's mouth. "He's just a bit emotional," he explained. "You'll have to excuse him. He's been under a lot of pressure lately due to some personal difficulties. He apologizes unreservedly for the way he has behaved. Don't you, Andre?" Christine said nothing. He just trembled, still fixated on the wreckage of the double bass. He wanted to reverse time, Floyd thought. He wanted to unhappen the last few minutes of his life and let them spool forward again. He would be obliging this time, answering the guard's questions civilly, and perhaps the damage that they would inevitably do to the double bass would not be irreparable.
"Say it," Floyd whispered.
"I apologize," Christine said. "Unreservedly. I apologize unreservedly." The inspector looked at him critically, then shrugged.
"What's done is done. In future you might take a leaf from your friend's book."
"I'll do that," Christine said numbly. Down below, the guard kicked the remains of the double bass into the river. The bits of wood were soon lost amidst the oozing debris that hugged the banks. Floyd's telephone was ringing when he let himself into his office on the third floor of an old building on the Rue du Dragon. He put down the mail he had just collected from his pigeonhole and snatched the receiver from its cradle. "Floyd Investigations," he said, raising his voice above the rumbling passage of a train and pulling the toothpick from his mouth. "How may—"
"Monsieur Floyd, where have you been?"
The voice, it sounded as if it belonged to an elderly man, was curious rather than complaining.
"I've been calling all afternoon and was about to give up."
"I'm sorry," Floyd said. "I've been out on investigative work."
"You might consider investing in a receptionist," the man said. "Or, failing that, an answering machine. I gather they are very popular with the Orthodox Jews.
Receptionists?
Answering machines. They employ magnetic tapes. I saw a model for sale in Rue des Rosiers only last week.
What a fascinating scientific world we live in. Floyd pulled out his chair and lowered himself into it.
Might I ask? I'm sorry. I should have introduced myself. My name is Blanchard. I'm calling from the 13th arrondissement. It's possible that I have a case for you.
Go ahead, Floyd said, half convinced that he must be dreaming. After everything that had happened lately, Greta walking out, the lack of work, the incident at the checkpoint, a case was the one thing he hadn't dared hope for.
I should warn you that it is a serious matter. I do not believe it will be a quick or simple investigation.
That's not a major problem. Floyd poured brandy into a waiting shot glass. What kind of case are we talking about, monsieur? Mentally, he flipped through the possibilities. Cheating spouses was always a lucrative line of work. Sometimes they had to be tailed for weeks on end. The same went for missing cats.
It's murder, Blanchard said.
Floyd allowed himself a bittersweet sip of the brandy. He felt his spirits plummet just as quickly as they'd risen.
That's a real shame. We can't take on a murder case.
No? Homicide's a job for the boys in the bowler hats, the boys from the K. They won't let me touch that kind of work.
Ah, but that is precisely the point. The police do not consider the incident to have been murder, or homicide, as you call it.
They don't?
They say it may have been suicide or misadventure. But in either case, they are not interested. You know how it is these days. They are far more interested in pursuing their own investigations.
I think I get you drift. An old habit already had him taking notes. Blanchard, 13th R, pos, homicide. It might amount to nothing, but if the conversation was interrupted, he would do his best to contact the caller again. He scribbled the date next to his note, and realized that it was 6 weeks since he had last made an entry on the pad. Supposing the police are wrong, what makes you think it wasn't suicide or an accident?
Because I knew the young lady involved.
And you don't think she was the type who might kill herself?
That I can't say. All I do know is that she did not care for heights. She told me so herself, and yet she fell from a fifth-floor balcony.
Floyd closed his eyes, wincing. He thought of the smashed double bass splintered on the cobbles. He hated fallers. He hated the idea of fallers, suicidal or otherwise. He sipped the brandy, willing the drink to blast away the image in his mind. "Where's the body now?" he asked.
"Dead and buried. Cremated, as it happens, as per her wishes. She died 3 weeks ago, on September the 20th. There was a post-mortem, I gather, but nothing suspicious came to light."
"Well, then..." Mentally, Floyd was already preparing to cross out his line of notes, convinced that the case was a non-starter. Maybe she was sleepwalking, or maybe she was upset about something, or maybe the railings on the balcony were loose. Did the police speak to the landlord?
They did. As it happens, I was her landlord. I assure you, the railings were perfectly secure.
It's nothing, Floyd told himself. It might be worth a day or two of investigative time. But all they would end up doing was reaching the same conclusion as the police. It was better than no case at all, but it was not going to solve Floyd's deeper financial malaise. He put down the fountain pen and picked up a letter knife instead. He slit open the first of several envelopes he had collected from his pigeonhole and spilled out a demand from his landlord.
"Monsieur Floyd, are you still there?"
"Just thinking," Floyd said. "It seems to me that it'd be difficult ever to rule out an accident. And without evidence of foul play, there's not much I can add to the official verdict."
"Evidence of foul play, Monsieur Floyd, is precisely what I have. Of course, the unimaginative idiots at the quay didn't want to know. I expect rather better of you."
Floyd wadded the rent demand into a ball and flicked it into his waste paper basket.
"Can you tell me about this evidence?"
"In person, yes. I would ask that you visit my apartment tonight.
Does your schedule permit it?"
"I should be able to slot you in." Floyd took down Blanchard's address and telephone number and agreed a time with the landlord. "Just one thing, monsieur. I can understand the K not being interested in the woman's case, but..."
But why have you called me? Are you implying that it was a mistake? No, not at all. It's just that most of my cases come through personal recommendation. I don't get much work through people finding my name in the telephone book. The man at the other end of the line chuckled knowingly. The sound was like coal being stirred in a grate. I should think not. You are an American, after all. Who but a fool would seek the services of an American detective in Paris? I'm French, Floyd said, slicing open the second envelope. Let us not quibble over passports. Your French is impeccable, Monsieur Floyd, for a foreigner. But I will say no more than that. You were born in the United States, were you not? You know a lot about me. How did you get my name? I got it from the only reasonable policeman I spoke to during this whole affair. An Inspector Maillol. I gather you and he know each other. Our paths have crossed. Maillol's a decent enough fellow. Can't he look into this supposed suicide? Maillol says his hands are tied. When I mentioned that the woman was American, your name naturally popped into his head. Where was she from? Dakota, I believe. Or perhaps it was Minnesota. Somewhere to the north, at least. I'm from Galveston, Floyd said. That puts us a world apart. Nonetheless, you will take on the case. We have an appointment, monsieur. We can discuss things then. Very well, then. I shall expect you on the hour. Floyd shook the second letter from its envelope, which was postmarked from Nice, a single sheet of grey paper folded in two, tipped out onto the desk. He flicked the paper open to reveal a handwritten message in watery ink that was only a shade darker than the paper on which it was written. He recognized the handwriting immediately. It was from Greta. Monsieur Floyd. Floyd dropped the letter as if it was stamped from hot metal. His finger seemed to tingle. He hadn't expected to hear from Greta again. Not in this life. It took him a few moments to adjust to her sudden intrusion back into his world. What could she possibly have to say to him? Monsieur Floyd, are you still there? He tapped the mouthpiece. Just lost you for a moment there, monsieur. It's the rats in the basement. Always at the telephone lines. Evidently. Upon the hour, then. Are we agreed? I'll be there, Floyd said. 2. Verity Auger surveyed the underground scene from the safety of her environment suit, standing a dozen meters from the crippled wreckage of the crawler. The tarantula-like machine lay tilted to one side, two of its legs broken and another three jammed uselessly against the low ceiling of carved ice. The crawler was going nowhere. It couldn't even be dragged back to the surface, but at least its life support bubble was still intact. Cassandra, the girl student, was still sitting inside the cabin, arms folded, watching the proceedings with a kind of haughty detachment. Sebastian, the boy, was lying about 5 meters from the crawler, his suit damaged but still capable of keeping him alive until the rescue squad arrived. "Hang in there," Auger told him on the suit to suit. "They're breaking through. We'll be home and dry any moment now." The crackle and static accompanying the boy's response made him seem a million light years away. "I don't feel too good, miss." "What's wrong?" "Headache." "Just stay still. Those suit seals will do their job if you don't move." Auger stepped back as rescue crawlers from the antiquities board emerged from above, forcing ice aside with piston-driven claws and picks. "That you, Auger?" came a voice in her helmet. "Of course it's me. What took you so long? Thought you guys were never coming." "We came as fast as we could." She recognized the voice of Mancuso, one of the recovery people she had dealt with in the past. "Had trouble getting a fix on you this far down. The clouds seem to be having some kind of argument tonight. Lots of electromagnetic crap to see through. What exactly were you doing this deep?"
"My job," she said tersely.
"The kid hurt?"
"His suit took a hit."
On her own faceplate monitor, she could still see the diagnostic summary for Sebastian's suit, hatched with pulsing red hazard indicators near the right elbow joint. "But it's nothing serious. I told him to lie down and keep still until rescue arrived." The lead crawler was already disgorging two members of the rescue squad, clad in the faintly comical suits of the extreme hazards section. They moved like sumo warriors in squatting strides. Auger moved to Sebastian, kneeling down next to him.
"They're here. All you have to do is keep still and you'll be safe and sound. Sebastian made an unintelligible gurgle in reply. Orga raised a hand, signaling the nearer of the two suits to approach her. This is the boy, Mancuso. I think you should deal with him first.
That's already the plan, another voice squawked in her helmet. Stand back, Orga.
Careful with him, she warned. He's got a bad rip near the right.
Mancuso's suit towered over the little boy.
Easy, son, she heard. Gonna have you fixed up in no time.
You all right in there?
Hurt, she heard Sebastian gasp.
Think we need to move fast on this one, Mancuso said, beckoning the second rescuer to him with a flick of one over-muscled arm. Can't risk moving him, not with the particle density as high as it is.
Recover in situ? The second rescuer asked.
Let's do it.
Mancuso pointed his left arm at the boy. A hatch slid open in the armor and a spray nozzle popped out. Silvery white matter gushed from the nozzle, solidifying instantly on impact. In a matter of seconds, Sebastian became a human-shaped cocoon wrapped in hard, spittle-like strands.
Careful with him, Olga repeated.
A second team then set to work, cutting into the block of ice immediately underneath Sebastian with lasers. Steam blasted into the air from the cutting point. They paused now and again, signaling each other with tiny hand gestures before resuming. The first team returned with a wheeled stretcher-like harness, pushing it between them. Thin metal claws lowered from the cradle, slipping into the ice around Sebastian. The cradle slowly hoisted the entire cocooned mass, including its foundation of ice, away from the ground. Orga watched them wheel Sebastian away and load him into the first recovery machine.
It was just a scratch, Orga said, when Mancuso returned to check on her.
You don't have to act as if it's an emergency, scaring the kid to death.
It'll be an experience for him.
He's already had enough experience for one day.
Well, can't be too careful. Down here all accidents are emergencies. Thought you'd have known that by now, Orga.
You should check on the girl, she said, indicating the crawler.
She hurt?
No.
Then she isn't a priority. Let's see what you risk these kids' lives for, shall we?
Mancuso meant the newspaper.
It's in the crawler's storage shelf,
Orga said, leading him over to the crippled machine. At the front of the crawler, tucked beneath sets of manipulator arms and tools, were a netting pouch and a hatch containing a compartmented storage tray. Orga released the manual catch and slid out the tray.
Look,
she said, taking the newspaper out of its slot with great care.
Whew,
Mancuso whistled, grudgingly impressed.
Where'd you find it?
She pointed to a sunken area just ahead of the wrecked machine.
We found a car down there.
Anyone inside?
Empty. We smashed the sunroof and used the crawler's manipulators to extract the paper from the rear seat.
We had to brace the crawler against the ceiling to prevent it from toppling over. Unfortunately, the ceiling wasn't structurally sound.
That's because this cavern hasn't been cleared for human operations yet, Mancuso told her.
Orga chose her words carefully, mindful that anything she said now might be on the record. No harm was done. We lost a crawler, but the recovery of a newspaper easily outweighs that.
What happened to the boy?
He was helping me stabilize the crawler when he ripped his suit. I told him to lie still and wait for the cavalry. She put the newspaper back into the tray. The newsprint was still as sharp and legible as when she had retrieved it from the car. The act of picking up the paper, flexing it slightly, had even caused one of the animated adverts to come to life, a girl on a beach throwing a ball towards the camera.
Pretty good, Orga. Looks like you lucked out this time.
Help me remove the tray, she said, guessing that there was going to be no attempt to recover the entire crawler.
They extracted the sample tray, carried it to the nearest rescue crawler, and slid it into a vacant slot.
Now the film reels, Mancuso said.
Orga walked around the leaning vehicle, throwing latches and sliding out the heavy black cartridges, clipping them together as she went for ease of transport. Once all 12 of them had been assembled, including those from the cabin monitors, she handed the bulky package to Mancuso. I want these shot straight to the lab, she said.
That's the lot, he asked.
That's the lot, Orga replied. Now can we deal with Cassandra?
But when she looked back into the glow of the cabin, she saw no sign of the girl.
Cassandra, she called, hoping that the channel to the crawler was still functioning.
"It's okay,"
the girl said. "I'm right behind you." Augur turned around to see Cassandra standing on the ice in the other child-sized environment suit.
"I told you to stay inside," Augur said. "It was time to leave," Cassandra replied.
She had, as far as Augur could tell, made an efficient and thorough job of donning her suit. Augur was impressed. It was difficult enough for an adult to put on an environment suit without assistance, let alone a child.
"Did you make sure?" Augur began. "The suit is fine. I think it's time we were leaving, don't you? All this activity may have alerted the Furies. We don't want to be here when they arrive."
Mancuso touched Augur's shoulder with a power-amplified glove that could have crushed her in an eye blink. "Girl's right. Let's get the hell out of Paris. Place always gives me the jitters." Augur peered through the ceiling porthole of the rescue crawler, willing the red and green lights of the dropship to burn through the clouds, and hoping that the clouds themselves would not become even more agitated. There was something wrong with the clouds tonight. Their talk was normally a slow and serene form of communication, revealed by changes in their shape, color, and texturing. Vast circuit-like structures of hard-edged blue-gray would take form over many minutes. These forms would gradually stabilize and then slowly fade. Tens of minutes later, new patterns would begin to emerge from the doughy gray of unstructured cloud. Such movements were merely the basic units of an exchange that might take hours or days to complete. But right now the clouds were bickering. The patterns formed and decayed at an accelerated rate, with lightning a kind of emphatic punctuation to the dialogue. The clouds fissioned and merged, as if renegotiating age-old treaties and alliances.
"They do this sometimes," Cassandra said.
"I know," Augur replied, "but not on my watch, and not right over the city I happen to be investigating."
"Maybe it's not just happening over Paris," Cassandra mused.
"I hoped so too. Unfortunately, I checked. There's a major argument in the weather system centered right over northern France, and it started thickening up at about the time we arrived."
"Coincidence?"
"Or not." Lightning illuminated the scene outside, picking out a linear obstacle course of blocks, ramps, and deep, smooth-sided trenches, all cut from pale blue ice with laser precision. On either side of the Champs-Élysées, the collapsed forms of buildings were glazed within traceries of the same pastel ice, neatly stepped and edged where the Antiquities Board's remote-controlled excavators had halted when they sensed fragile masonry, steel, and glass. Augur thought about the controllers who directed those machines from orbit, and felt a growing desire to be up there with them, away from the hazards of the ground.
"Hurry up," she said sotto voce. "This stopped being fun hours ago." "Was it really worth it? For a single newspaper?" Cassandra asked.
"Of course it was worth it. You know it was. Newspapers are amongst the most valuable void century artifacts we can ever hope to find, especially late editions, updated in the last few hours before it all ended. You wouldn't believe how few of those survived." Cassandra pushed aside the curtain of black hair that had a habit of falling over her left eye.
"What does it matter if there are some details you still don't know, if you can still make out the bigger picture?"
Movement caught Augur's attention. Through the ceiling porthole she saw a squadron of dropships lowering down through the clouds on spikes of thrust.
"It means we stand a chance of not making the same mistakes over again," Augur said.
"Such as?" Cassandra asked. "Screwing up the Earth, for instance. Thinking we can fix one technological mess by throwing yet more technology at it, when every attempt to do that already has just made things even worse."
"Only a kind of superstitious fatalism would say that we shouldn't keep trying," Cassandra said,
folding her arms across her chest.
"Anyway, how could things possibly be any worse than they are now?"
"Use your imagination, kid," Augur said. She felt the rescue crawler tremble as the thrust from the nearest dropship washed over it. Bright light played over the cabin, followed by a lurch as the recovery cradle grabbed hold of the rescue crawler. Then they were airborne, pulled into the sky as the dropship gained altitude. Through the side windows, Augur saw the Champs-Élysées fall away, the slumped buildings on either side soon hiding it from view. She made out the surrounding streets, unable to turn off the part of her brain that insisted on identifying them. Haussmann to the north, Marceau and Montaigne to the south.
"How could we make it worse?" Cassandra said. People can't live down there. Nothing can, not even bacteria. Surely that's as bad as it gets.
We scored today, Auger said. We came back with a piece of the past, a window into history. But there's a lot more down there we haven't found yet, gaps in our knowledge waiting to be filled. There's so much we forgot, so many things we'll never know unless we find the truth down there, preserved under the ice.
The polity plans don't threaten any of that.
Not on paper, no. But we all know that the plans are only a prelude.
Clean up the Furies and stabilize the climate, then we can begin the real work.
Terraforming. She said the last word with exquisite distaste.
As the clouds thickened around the rescue crawler, Auger caught a brief glimpse of the sinuous track of the Seine, a flawless ribbon of white ice dotted here and there with cordoned dig sites. Further away, picked out in darkling glints from hovering airships, she made out the lower two-thirds of the Eiffel Tower, bent to one side like a man struggling against a gale.
Is it such a crime to want to make the Earth livable again? Cassandra asked.
In my book it is, because we can't do it without erasing everything down there, severing every single thread back to the past. It's like whitewashing the Mona Lisa when there's a blank canvas next door.
So you advocate the terraforming of Venus instead?
Auger felt close to tearing out her hair.
No, I don't advocate that either. It's just that if I'm forced into making a choice...
She shook her head.
I don't know why I'm having this conversation with you of all people.
Why wouldn't you?
Because you're one of us, Cassandra. A good little thresher. A good little citizen of the Usni. You're even studying to work under antiquities. I shouldn't have to explain any of this stuff to you.
Cassandra gave a girlish little shrug, accompanied by a half pout.
I thought debate was supposed to be healthy, she countered.
It is, Auger replied, so long as you don't disagree with me.
Tanglewood wrapped the earth in light, like a glimmering funeral wreath. The dropship moved cautiously, veering this way and that as it navigated between moving threads, each of which was an enormous chain of interconnected habitats. In every direction, there were more and more loops, threads, and knots of light, receding into a faint, luminous scribble of headache-inducing complexity, each center of mass following its own private orbit around Earth. Hundreds of thousands of habitats, each a small city in its own right, hundreds of millions of people, Auger knew, all with lives as complex and problematic and hope-filled as her own. Traffic was constantly coming and going from different parts of Tanglewood, sparks of light slipping from one thread to another in all directions. The concatenated threads of linked habitats were in a constant process of severance and reunion, like DNA strands in some thriving petri dish. Her mood brightened when she felt the dropship braking for its final approach. Immediately ahead, strung together, hub to hub, were the six counter-rotating wheels of the Antiquities Board. Already, she was certain, the news of her discovery would be filtering through the usual academic channels, and the pressure would soon be mounting for her to publish a preliminary summary of the newspaper's contents. She would be very lucky if she got any sleep in the next 24 hours. It would, however, be the kind of work she enjoyed, tiring but simultaneously exhilarating, leaving her in a state of exhausted euphoria at the end of it. And that would only be the beginning of the much longer process of detailed study, when she would see whether her initial hunches and guesses stood the test of time. The squadron of dropships docked with the first wheel, coming to rest in a large low-gravity reception bay filled with ships and equipment. With a prickle of disquiet, Auger noticed that one of the parked spacecraft was a slasher vessel. It was ostentatiously sleek, long and lean, like a fast-swimming squid, with something of the same translucent elegance. Mechanisms and markings twinkled through the cobalt-blue luster of its outer hull. Surrounded by the robust but clumsy artifacts of her own government, the slasher craft looked insultingly futuristic, which, in a way, it was. Auger couldn't quite pinpoint the reason for her unease. It was unusual to see a slasher ship in Tanglewood, especially with the heightened tension of recent months. But it did still happen now and then, and whenever there were diplomatic exchanges, it was generally more efficient to use slasher transport. But in Antiquities, that, she had to admit, was a little unusual. She pushed the unease from her mind, concentrating on the matter at hand.
While various aggressive sterilization procedures took place, the ships scrubbed for any latent traces of Parisian contamination. Auger scoured the rescue crawler until she found a pen and a pad of standard-issue antiquities reporting paper and set about writing her statement regarding what had happened underground. As always, it was necessary to strike a balance between a cavalier disregard for the rules and a professional understanding that some rules were more flexible than others. She had pretty much finished the report by the time the sterilization procedures were completed. An airlock bridge was attached to the rescue craft, and the lights around the outer door flicked to green, signaling that it was safe to disembark. The recovery crew were the first out, anxious to get off shift to trade drinks and tall tales with their comrades. "Come on," she said, gesturing for Cassandra to exit ahead of her.
"After you," the girl replied.
Something in her tone was still off, but Auger continued to put it down to her own nerves, amplified by the sighting of the slasher vessel. She pulled herself to the airlock and, with well-rehearsed movements, drifted along the connecting umbilical. At the far end, she was met by a pair of officials, both of whom wore pinstriped grey suits. She recognized one of the men as a high-level manager called August Da Silva. He was a small individual with a smooth, cherubic face and hair that was always impeccably combed and held in place with perfumed oils. Their paths had crossed before, over research budgets and minor procedural transgressions. Da Silva made a show of separating Auger from the girl.
"This way for you," he said.
"I need to look after Cassandra," Auger said. With a gentle push, Da Silva coaxed her into a small windowless waiting room. The door was immediately closed and locked behind her, leaving her alone with only the padded walls for company. Auger thumped on the door, but no one came back or gave any explanation as to what was going on. Half an hour passed, then an hour. Auger began to stew in her own indignation, rehearsing the things she would say and the people she would lash out at when she was finally allowed to leave. Nothing like this had ever happened before. There were sometimes delays due to glitches in the sterilization procedure, but the authorities were always careful to keep her informed in such circumstances. After another half hour, the door opened and Da Silva poked his perfumed head through the gap.
"Time to move, Auger. They're waiting for you."
She managed a defiant sneer.
"Who the hell are they? Don't you realize I've got work to do?"
"Your work will have to wait a while."
Grumpily, she followed Da Silva out of the waiting room. He smelled of lavender and cinnamon.
"I need to collect the newspaper and the film reels so that I can begin documenting the discovery. This is major. There are thousands of people waiting to hear what the newspaper will tell us. They'll already be wondering why I haven't made a preliminary statement."
"I'm afraid I can't let you have the film reels," Da Silva said. "They've already been sent away for secure processing."
"What are you talking about?"
"That's my damn data."
"It isn't data anymore," the man said. "It's evidence in a criminal investigation. The boy died."
The force of it hit her like a stomach punch.
"No,"
she breathed, as if denying it might make any difference.
"I'm afraid it's true."
Her voice sounded ghostly and distant.
"What happened?"
"There was a rip in his suit. Furies got to him."
Auger remembered Sebastian complaining of a headache. That would have been the tiny machine storming through his brain, replicating and demolishing as they went. The thought made her sick.
"But we checked the fury count," she said. "It was zero."
"Your detectors weren't sensitive to the latest microscopic strain. You'd have known that if you bothered to keep up with the technical bulletins. You should have allowed for that factor in deciding whether to go outside."
"But he can't be dead.
He died during the ascent."
Da Silva looked back at her, perhaps wondering how much he was allowed to say.
"Complete brainstem death."
"Oh, God."
She took a deep breath, trying not to lose it.
"Has anyone told his family?"
"They've been informed that an incident took place. They're on their way over as we speak. The hope is that the boy can be brought back to some state of consciousness by the time they arrive."
Da Silva was playing with her.
"You told me he died."
"He did. Thankfully, they were able to bring him back.
With a head full of furies?"
"They pumped him full of UR, flushed out the furies with some of that magic slasher medicine. Right now, the boy's still in a coma. He may have irreversible damage to major brain structures, but we won't know for a few days.
This can't be happening, Auger said. She felt like a spectator to her own conversation.
It was just a field trip. No one was supposed to die.
Easy to say now.
He leaned in closer so that she could smell his breath.
Do you honestly think we can keep a lid on this kind of thing? We've already got the Transgressions Board breathing down our necks. There have been a lot of screw-ups down on Earth lately, and word is they feel it's about time they made an example of someone before something really stupid happens.
I'm sorry about the boy, she said.
Is that an admission of culpability, Auger? If so, it's going to make things a lot easier all round.
No, she said, her voice faltering. It's not an admission of anything. I'm just saying that I'm sorry. Look, can I speak to the parents?
Right now, Auger, I'd think you are about the last person in the solar system they'll want to talk to.
I just want them to know I care.
The time to care, De Silva said, was before you risked everything for a single useless artifact.
The artifact isn't useless, she snapped. No matter what happened down there, it was still a risk worth taking. You talk to anyone in antiquities and they'll tell you the same thing.
Shall I show you the newspaper, Auger? Would you like that?
De Silva had it stuffed into his jacket. He pulled it out and handed it to her. She took it with trembling fingers, feeling all her hopes vanish in one instant of crushing disappointment. Like the boy, the newspaper had died as well. The newsprint had blurred, lines of text running into each other like icing patterns melting on a cake. It was already completely illegible. The illustrations and advertisements had become static, their colors bleeding together until they looked like splodges of abstract art. The tiny motor that supplied power to the smart paper must have been down to its last trickle of energy when she pulled it from the car. She handed him back the useless, mocking thing.
I'm in trouble, aren't I?
3. Floyd swung the Mathis into a narrow street between tall-sided tenements. It was years since he had been on the Rue des Peupliers, and his memory was of broken cobbles, boarded-up premises, and shabby pawnbrokers. The road was smoothly asphalted now, and the parked autos were all gleaming 1950s models, low and muscular like crouched panthers. The posts of the electric street lamps gleamed with new paint. The street-level establishments were all discreet, high-class affairs, clockmakers, antiquarian booksellers, exclusive jewelers, a shop selling maps and globes, another specializing in fountain pens. As afternoon turned to evening, the storefronts threw welcoming rectangles of light onto the darkening sidewalk.
There's number 23, Floyd said, easing the car into a space next to the apartment building Blanchard had given as his address. That's where she must have fallen, he added, nodding towards a patch of sidewalk that showed every sign of having been recently scrubbed. Must have been from one of those balconies above us.
Christine looked out of the side window. No sign of damaged railings on any of them. Doesn't look as though any of them have been replaced and repainted lately, either. Floyd reached back and Christine passed him his notebook and fedora. We'll see. As they got out of the car, a small girl wearing scuffed black shoes and a stained dress emerged from the building and walked out onto the street. Floyd was about to call out to her before she allowed the door to close, but the words stalled in his throat when he saw her face. Even in the fading light, some suggestion of disfigurement or strangeness was apparent. He watched her skip down the street, finally disappearing into the shadows between the lights. Resignedly, Floyd tried the glass-fronted door that the girl had just come through and found it locked. Next to it was a panel of buzzers accompanied by the names of the tenants. He found Blanchard's and pressed it. A voice crackled through the grill immediately.
You are late, Monsieur Floyd.
Does that mean the appointment is off? In place of an answer, there was a buzz from the door. Christine pushed it experimentally and the door opened a crack.
Let's see how this plays out, Floyd said. Usual drill. I'll do most of the talking. You sit and observe.
That was the way they normally worked. Floyd had long ago found that his not-quite-perfect French lulled people into a false sense of security, often encouraging them to blurt out things that they might otherwise have held back.
The hallway led immediately to a carpeted flight of stairs, which they took to the third floor landing, both of them wheezing from the climb when they arrived. Three of the doors were shut, but the fourth was slightly ajar, a crack of electric light spilling onto the well-worn carpet. An eye loomed in the gap.
"This way, Monsieur Floyd, please."
The crack widened enough to admit Floyd and Custine into a living room, where the curtains had already been drawn against the advancing gloom of evening. "This is my associate, André Custine," Floyd said. "This being a homicide investigation, I thought two pairs of eyes and ears might be better than one." Blanchard nodded courteously towards each of them.
"Would you care for some tea? The kettle is still warm."
Custine started to say something, but Floyd was already thinking about how little time he had before his meeting with Greta, and got in first. "Very kind of you, monsieur, but we'd best be getting on with the investigation." He removed his fedora and placed it on an empty chess table. "Where do you want to begin?"
"I rather expected you to take the lead," Blanchard said, moving to close the door behind them.
Floyd's mental image of the caller on the telephone had turned out to be reassuringly close to the mark. Blanchard was a thin old gentleman in his 70s, with a crook of a nose upon which balanced a pair of half-moon spectacles. He wore a kind of fez or nightcap that resisted precise identification, a quilted nightgown covered striped pajamas, thick slippers his feet.
"Maybe you should go back to the beginning," Floyd said. "Tell me about the American girl. How much did you know about her?"
"She was a tenant, and she paid her rent on time."
For a moment, Blanchard fussed with a fire iron, poking away at the ashes in the room's enormous Art Deco fireplace. On the mantelpiece, two bookend owls surveyed the proceedings with jeweled eyes. Floyd and Custine squeezed in next to each other on the sofa, shuffling awkwardly.
"That's all?" Floyd prompted.
Blanchard turned from the fireplace.
"She stayed here for 3 months until her death. She kept the room 2 floors above this one. She would rather have had one a little lower, as I think I mentioned, she did not like heights, but none was available."
"Did she complain to you about that?" Floyd asked.
His eyes wandered over the walls, taking in an array of African masks and hunting trophies, none of which looked as if they had been dusted in recent memory. A portrait photograph hung next to the door, showing a handsome young couple in front of the Eiffel Tower. Their clothing and slightly stiff expression suggested a picture taken at least 50 years earlier. Floyd studied the young man's face and measured it against the old gentleman who was their host.
"She complained to me, yes," Blanchard said, easing himself into a chair. "To her landlord, no."
"I thought you were," Floyd began.
"I was her landlord, yes, but she did not know that. None of the tenants are aware that I am anything more than another tenant. They pay their rent through an intermediary."
"Odd arrangement," Floyd observed.
"But a very useful one. I get to hear their official complaints and grievances and their unofficial ones as well, simply by chatting as we pass on the stairs. The woman in question never expressed her displeasure in writing, but she never failed to complain about the room whenever our paths crossed."
Floyd flashed a glance at his partner, then looked at Blanchard.
"The girl's name, monsieur?"
"The woman's name was Susan White."
"Married?"
"She did not wear a ring and never spoke of anyone else."
Floyd noted down this information.
"Did she tell you how old she was?"
"I doubt that she was older than 35, maybe only 30. It was not easy to tell. She did not wear as much makeup as the other young women, the other female tenants."
Custine asked, "Did she tell you what she had been doing before she came here?"
"Only that she had come from America, and that she had some skill as a typist. I should mention the typewriter."
"Where in America?" Floyd interrupted, remembering that Blanchard had not been certain when they spoke on the telephone.
"It was Dakota. I remember that quite clearly now. It was in her accent," she said.
"Then she spoke English to you?" Floyd asked.
"Now and then when I asked her to. Otherwise, her French was much like yours."
"Impeccable," Floyd said with a smile. "For a foreigner, that is."
"What was Mademoiselle White doing in Paris?"
Custine asked.
"She never told me, and I never asked. Clearly, funds were not a problem. She may have had some work, but if that was the case, then she kept very erratic hours. Floyd turned a page on his notepad, thumbing it down to blot the ink on the notes he had already made.
Sounds like a tourist, spending a few months in Paris before moving on.
You mind if I ask how you got to know each other, and how far that relationship went?
It was an entirely harmless association. We happened to meet at Longchamp.
The races?
Yes, I see you've noticed a photograph of my late wife and me.
Floyd nodded, a little ashamed that his scrutiny had been so obvious. She was very pretty.
The photograph doesn't begin to do her justice. Her name was Claudette. She died in 1954, only 5 years ago, but it feels as if I've spent half my life without her.
I'm sorry, Floyd said.
Claudette was a great fan of the races.
Blanchard got up again and poked around in the fire to no visible effect. He sat down with a creak of aging joints.
After she died, there was a long time when I couldn't bring myself to leave this apartment, let alone go back to the races. But one day I persuaded myself to do just that, intending to put some money on a horse in her memory. I told myself that it was what she would have wanted. But all the same, I couldn't help but feel a little guilty that I was there on my own.
You shouldn't have felt that way, Floyd said.
Blanchard looked at him. Have you ever been married, Monsieur Floyd, or lost a loved one to a slow disease?
Floyd looked down, chastened.
No, monsieur. Then, with all due respect, you can't really know what it is like. That feeling of betrayal, absurd as it was. Yet still I kept going, saving a little money each week, occasionally returning with a small win. And that was where I met Suzanne White.
Did the girl gamble?
Not seriously. She recognized me only as another tenant and asked if I might help her with a small wager. At first I was reluctant to have anything to do with her, since I almost felt as if Claudette was watching me, as silly as that seems.
But you did help her.
I decided that it would do no harm to show her how to study the form, and she placed a bet accordingly. Rather to her surprise, the horse triumphed. Thereafter she arranged to meet me at the races once or twice a week. Frankly, I think the horses fascinated her more than the money. I would catch her staring at them as they circled in the jockey's enclosure. It was as if she had never seen horses before.
Maybe they don't have them in Dakota, Christine said.
And that was as far as it went, Floyd asked. A meeting at the races, once or twice a week.
That was how it started, Blanchard said, and perhaps that is how it should have ended, too. But I found that I enjoyed her company. In her, I saw something of my late wife, the same zest for life, the same childlike delight in the simplest things. The truly surprising thing was that she appeared to enjoy my company as well.
So you started to meet up outside the racetrack.
Once or twice a week I would invite her into this room, and we would drink tea and coffee and perhaps eat a slice of cake, and we would talk about anything that crossed our minds. Or rather I would talk, since most of the time at least, she seemed content to sit and listen.
Blanchard smiled, wrinkles splitting his face.
I would say, now it's your turn. I've been monopolizing the conversation. And she would reply, no, no, I really want to hear your stories. And the odd thing is, she seemed quite sincere.
We talk about anything, the past, the movies, theater.
And did you ever get a look inside her apartment?
Of course. I was her landlord. When she was out, it was a simple matter to use the duplicate key.
It wasn't snooping, he added a little defensively, leaning forward to make his point.
I have a duty to my other tenants to make sure that the terms of the contract are being honored.
I'm sure, Floyd said. When you were in there not snooping around, did you notice anything?
Only that the place was always very neat and tidy, and that she collected a remarkable number of books, records, magazines, and newspapers.
A proper little bookworm, in other words.
Not a crime, though, is it?
Not unless they've changed the law. Blanchard paused. There was one thing that struck me as rather unusual, though. Shall I mention it?
Couldn't hurt.
The books kept changing. They were the same from day to day, yes, but from week to week they changed. So did the magazines and newspapers.
It was as if she was collecting them, then moving them on somewhere else to make room for new ones.
Maybe she was, Floyd said. If she was a rich tourist, then she might have been shipping goods back home on a regular basis.
I considered that possibility, yes.
And? Floyd asked.
One day I happened to see her in the street, a long way from the apartment. It was a coincidence. She was making her way down Roumange, towards the metro station at Cardinal Lemoine, in the 5th arrondissement. She was struggling with a suitcase, and the thought flashed through my mind that perhaps she had packed her belongings and left,
skipping on her rent.
Except she had already paid in advance up to the end of the month. Guilty over my suspicions, I vowed to catch up with her and help her with the suitcase. But I am an elderly man, and I could not make up the distance quickly enough. Ashamed that I could not be of assistance to her, I watched her vanish into the metro station. Blanchard picked up a carved pipe from a selection on a side table and began examining it absently. I thought that was the end of it, but no sooner had she vanished than she reappeared. No more than a minute or two had passed since she entered, and she still had the suitcase. This time, however, it looked much lighter than before. It was a windy day, and now the suitcase kept bumping against her hip.
You told all this to the police? Floyd asked.
I did, but they dismissed it. They told me that I had imagined the whole incident, or imagined that the first suitcase was heavier than the second.
Floyd made a careful note, certain, without quite being able to say why, that this was an important observation. And this is the evidence of foul play you mentioned on the telephone.
No, Blanchard said. That is something else entirely. 2 or 3 weeks before her death, Mademoiselle White's manner changed. She stopped coming to the races, stopped visiting these rooms, and spent more and more time away from her own apartment. On the few occasions when we passed each other on the stairs, she seemed distracted.
Did you check out her rooms?
Blanchard hesitated a moment before nodding in answer to Floyd's question. She had stopped acquiring books and magazines. A great many remained in the apartment, but I saw no sign that they were being added to or relocated elsewhere.
Floyd glanced at Christine. All right. Something must have been on her mind. I have a theory. You want to hear it? Am I paying for this? We haven't discussed terms. We'll come to that if we come to it. I think Mademoiselle White had a lover. She must have met someone in the last 3 weeks before she died.
Floyd observed Blanchard, wondering how much of this he really wanted to know.
She'd been spending time with you, innocently, I know. But suddenly her new boyfriend wanted her all to himself. No more trips to the races, no more cozy chats up here.
Blanchard seemed to weigh the matter.
And the matter of the books?
Just a guess. But maybe she suddenly had other things to do than hang around bookstores and newsagents. She lost interest in stocking her library, so there was no need to keep on shipping trunks back to Dakota.
That's a lot of supposition, Blanchard said,
based on a rather striking absence of evidence.
I said it was a theory, not a watertight case.
Floyd took out a toothpick and started chewing on it.
All I'm saying is, there might be less to this than meets the eye.
And the matter of her death?
The fall might still have been an accident.
I am convinced she was pushed. Blanchard reached under his chair and produced a tin box, printed all over with a scratched tartan pattern, a photograph of a Highland Terrier on the lid. This, perhaps, will convince you.
Floyd took the tin. I really need to watch my figure.
Open it, please.
Floyd prized the lid off with his fingernails. Inside was a bundle of assorted documents and papers, held together with a single rubber band.
You'd better explain the significance of this, Floyd said, nonplussed. Less than a week before she died, Mademoiselle White knocked on my door. She died on the 20th. This would have been around the 15th or 16th. I let her in. She was still flustered, still distracted, but now at least she was ready to talk to me. The first thing she did was apologize for her rudeness during the preceding fortnight and tell me how much she missed the horses. She also gave me that box.
Floyd slipped free the elastic band surrounding the papers and let them spill into his lap.
What else did she tell you? Only that she might have to leave Paris in a hurry, and that I was to look after the box if she did not return for it.
Floyd glanced through the papers. There were travel documents, receipts, maps, newspaper clippings. There was a pencil sketch, carefully annotated, of something circular that he didn't recognize. There was a postcard, a sun-faded photograph of Notre Dame. Floyd flipped it over and saw that the card had been written and stamped, but never sent. The handwriting was neat and girlish, with exaggerated loops and curlicues. It was addressed to someone called Mr. Caliscan, who lived in Tanglewood, Dakota. You mind if I read this?
Go ahead, Monsieur Floyd.
The first part of the message talked about how the woman was planning to spend the afternoon shopping, looking for some silver jewelry, but that she might have to change her plans if the weather turned to rain. The words silver and rain had been neatly underlined. This struck Floyd momentarily as odd, before he remembered an elderly aunt who had been in the habit of underlining key words in the letters she sent him. The postcard was signed From Susan. Floyd speculated that it had been intended for an uncle or grandfather rather than a lover or close friend. He opened one of the maps, spreading it wide. He had expected a tourist map of Paris, or at the very least of France, but this was a small-scale map of the whole of Western Europe, from Kaliningrad in the north to Bucharest in the south, from Paris in the west to Odessa in the east. A circle had been inked around Paris and another around Berlin, and the two circles were linked by a perfectly straight line in the same ink. Another circle enclosed Milan, which was in turn connected back to Paris by another line. The effect was the creation of an approximate L shape, with Paris at the corner of the L and Berlin at the end of the longest side. Marked in neat lettering above the lines were two figures, 875 above the Paris-Berlin axis and 625 along that between Paris and Milan. Floyd speculated that these were the distances between the cities, in kilometers rather than miles. He scratched at the ink with his fingernail, satisfying himself that it was not part of the original printed design. He had no idea what the markings meant, but he speculated that Susan White might have been planning the next leg of her journey, and had been measuring the respective distances between Paris and the two other cities before deciding which to opt for. But what kind of tourist needed to know such distances so precisely? Trains and even aeroplanes did not follow straight-line routes, given the real and political geography of Europe. But perhaps that detail had escaped her. Floyd folded the map, and then leafed through the rest of the paperwork. There was a typed letter in German from someone called Altfeld, on thick letterhead paper printed with a company insignia for a heavy manufacturing concern named Caspar Metals. The address was somewhere in Berlin, and the letter appeared to be in reply to an earlier query Susan White had sent. Beyond that, Floyd's faltering German wasn't up to the task of translation. "These don't look much like love letters," Floyd said.
"She gave me one other instruction," Blanchard said, "in the event that she did not return. She said that her sister might come looking for her. If she did, I was to pass on the box to her."
"She was worried about something," Floyd said. "Not much we can agree on."
"You're still not convinced that she might have been killed deliberately? Shouldn't you be keen to take on a murder case? I will pay you for your time. If you find no evidence that she was murdered, then I will accept your judgment."
"I don't want to waste your money or my time," Floyd said. Christine cast him a sidelong glance, as if questioning his sanity.
"I am authorizing you to waste it."
Floyd stuffed the documents back into the tin. "Why don't you just hold on to this and see if the sister shows up?
Because every day that passes is a day longer since she died."
"All due respect, monsieur, but this really isn't something you need to concern yourself with."
"I think it is very much my concern." "What did the police make of the box?" Christine asked.
"I showed it to them, but of course they weren't interested. As I said, entirely too unimaginative."
"You think she might have been a spy?" Floyd guessed.
"The thought had crossed my mind. Please do not pretend it has not crossed yours."
"I don't know what to make of any of this," Floyd said. "What I do know is that it never hurts to keep an open mind."
"Then keep an open mind about the possibility that she was murdered. I owe it to the memory of that lovely young girl not to let her death go unpunished. I know in my heart that someone was responsible, Monsieur Floyd. I also know that Claudette is watching me now, and she would be very disappointed if I did not do my duty to Mademoiselle White."
"That's very decent of you,"
Floyd began.
It's not just decency,
Blanchard interrupted sharply.
There is a selfish component as well. Until her killer is found, there will always be doubts in my other tenants' minds that perhaps she did fall accidentally.
But the police have never made any such suggestion.
A suggestion does not have to be voiced, Blanchard said. Please, take the box and see where it takes you. Talk to the other tenants, discreetly, of course. She may have spoken to some of them as well. What shall we say in terms of her retainer?
Floyd reached into his jacket and took out one of his dog-eared business cards. Those are my usual terms. Since this is a homicide investigation, my associate will also be assisting me. That means the rates are doubled.
I thought you wanted to save me money.
It's your call, but if we're going to investigate Mademoiselle White's death, there's no point in half measures. Christine and I can cover twice as much ground in half the time it would take me on my own. Blanchard took the card and pocketed it without a glance.
I accept your terms.
For my money, however, I will expect a swift resolution. You'll get it one way or the other.
That suits me fine.
I need to know what she told you about her sister.
That's the funny thing.
Until that last conversation, the one when she gave me the box, she never mentioned any family at all. Did she give you a description of her sister?
Yes, her name is Verity. She has blonde hair, not red. Mademoiselle White was particular about that detail, but she's otherwise about the same height and build.
Blanchard pushed himself to his feet.
In that respect, you are fortunate. I took a picture of her at Longchamp.
Blanchard pulled out a pair of photographs from beneath one of the owls on the mantelpiece.
You may keep both of them.
Are these your only copies?
No, I had a number of duplicate prints made when I was expecting the police to take an interest in matters. I assumed they would want them for their inquiries.
Floyd examined one of the pictures of Susan White. It was a full-length shot of her standing up against a backdrop of railings, with the elongated blur of a horse passing behind. She was holding on to her pillbox hat as if the wind had been about to snatch it away. She was laughing, startled and happy. She did not look like someone who would be dead in a few weeks.
She was an attractive young woman, Blanchard said, settling back into his seat. But I hardly need tell you that. She had the most beautiful red hair. It's a shame that you can't really see it, bundled up under that hat. She usually wore green. I always think redheads look good in green, don't you?
I wouldn't know, Floyd said. Christine examined the picture. Quite a looker.
Are they all like that in America?
Not in Galveston, Floyd replied. Two further flights of stairs led up to the rooms that the American woman had occupied during her last 3 months of life. Blanchard informed Floyd that the apartment had not been occupied since her fall. It's barely been touched, he added. The room has been aired out, but other than that, it's exactly as she left it. Even the bed was made. She was a very tidy young woman, unlike some of my tenants.
I see what you mean about the books, Floyd said, the floorboards creaking as he moved to examine the collection Susan White had accumulated.
Books, magazines, and newspapers occupied every horizontal surface, including a significant acreage of the floor space. But they were neatly stacked and segregated, hinting at a strictly methodical process of acquisition and storage prior to shipment. He remembered Blanchard's sighting of her making her way to the metro station with a loaded suitcase, and guessed that she must have made dozens of such journeys every week, if the collection had been changed as often as Blanchard claimed.
Perhaps you will see some rhyme or reason to it that escapes me, Blanchard said, hesitating at the threshold.
Floyd bent down to get a better look at a stack of phonograph records. Were these part of the stuff she was collecting and shipping as well?
Yes, examine them at your leisure.
Floyd leafed through the mint-condition recordings, hoping for some insight into the woman's thought processes. But the records were as varied in content as the rest of the material. There were jazz recordings, some of which Floyd owned himself, and a handful of classical recordings. But the rest of the collection appeared to have been compiled at random, with no consideration for genre or intrinsic merit. So she liked music, he commented.
Except she never played any of those records, Blanchard said.
Floyd looked at one of the records more closely, studying the sleeve and then the groove of the platter itself with a narrowed, critical eye.
Lately, a great many low-quality bootlegs had begun to turn up on the record market. They sounded acceptable to the untrained ear, but to anyone who really cared about music, they were an insult. Rumor had it that the bootleggers were operating somewhere in the Paris area, stamping out the cheap copies in an underground pressing plant. Having been stung by one or two of these poor copies himself, Floyd had learned to sniff them out. It seemed likely that more than a few of the dead woman's records were bootlegs, but if she didn't even listen to them in the first place, she had only herself to blame. Returning the record to its sleeve and standing up, Floyd noticed an old clockwork phonograph tucked away in one corner of the room, next to a more modern valve wireless. "Was that phonograph hers?" he asked.
"No, it came with the room. It must have been there for 30 years.
And she never played any of these records on it.
I never heard her play any music at all. On the few occasions when I happened to be passing this room or visiting the one below it, I only heard the noises from the radio."
"What sort of noises?"
"I couldn't hear them properly. She always had the radio turned down very low."
Floyd rubbed his finger through the dust on the top of the wireless. "Have you used this thing since she died?"
"As I said, the room has been aired, but that is all."
"You mind if I find out what she was listening to?"
"You are in my employment now, Monsieur Floyd. I authorize you to do as you see fit."
"I'll check the balcony," Christine said. "See how easy it would have been to fall from it."
Floyd knelt down next to the wireless set, having first smoothed out the scuffed and rucked-up carpet in front of it. It was a 20-year-old Philips set in a walnut-veneered cabinet. Floyd had owned one much like it during his first 5 years in Paris. He turned the wireless on, hearing the hum of warming valves and a crackle from the speaker grill. It still worked. He felt a breeze on the back of his neck as Christine opened the double doors that led to the balcony. The distant sound of traffic pushed itself into the room, disturbing the silence like a disrespectful guest. Floyd's hand moved instinctively to the tuning dial, preparing to make the little arrow slide along the illuminated band displaying printed wavelengths and transmitting stations. He knew all the stations that still broadcast the kind of music he and Christine liked to listen to and play. There were fewer of them each year, fewer each month, it seemed lately. With the dial where Susan White had left it, Floyd turned up the volume. All he heard was static. "It's off station," Floyd commented. "Either that or whoever was sending on this wavelength isn't sending anymore." He took out his notebook, flipped to the first clean page, and made a note of the position of the dial. Then he turned it, sliding the arrow from one end of the tuning band to the other. The wireless hissed and crackled, but at no point did Floyd tune into a recognizable signal.
"Well?" Blanchard asked.
"There must be something wrong with the radio. I should have tuned into something by now.
The wireless set was working perfectly before Mademoiselle White occupied the room.
And maybe it was working when she was here as well. But it's dead now, unless every station in France has just gone off the air." Floyd returned the dial to the approximate position it had been in when he entered the room, then switched off the wireless. "It doesn't matter. I just thought there might be a clue to her state of mind if we knew what she had been listening to."
Christine came back in from the balcony, shutting the double doors behind him.
"It's secure," he said. He touched his midriff. "The railings come up to here. How tall was she, monsieur?"
"About your height."
"Then I suppose she might have tripped and gone over if she was unlucky," Christine observed, "but there's no way she could have fallen just by leaning against them."
"Then discount that hypothesis," the landlord said. "Consider instead the possibility that she was pushed."
"Or that she jumped," Floyd said. He closed his notebook with a snap. "All right, I think we have enough here for now. You'll keep this room as it is for the time being."
"Until the matter is resolved," Blanchard assured him.
Floyd patted Christine on the back. "Come on, let's have a chat with the other tenants, see what they have to say." Christine leaned down and picked up the biscuit tin from where Floyd had left it, next to the wireless.
"The door to this apartment," he said, addressing Blanchard. "Was it locked when they found her?"
"No, it was open."
"Then she could have been murdered," Christine said. "Or she could have left the door open because she had something else on her mind," Floyd said. "It doesn't prove anything. What about the front door? Was that open as well?"
"No," Blanchard said. "It was locked, but it's a slam lock,
When the murderer left, he would only have had to close it behind him. He didn't need a key for that.
And you haven't noticed anything missing from here?
I'd have mentioned it if I had.
Christine patted the tin. Maybe they were looking for this but didn't find it because she'd already passed it on to Monsieur Blanchard.
Did anything in that box look like it was worth murdering someone for? Floyd said.
No, Christine replied. But when I was at the quay, I saw people murdered for a loaf of bread.
Floyd turned to the landlord. I'll telephone you tomorrow if I have any news. Otherwise, I'll just continue my investigations until I have something worth reporting.
I would like to hear from you every day, irrespective of your findings.
Floyd shrugged. If that's what you want.
You may call me in the evening. At the end of each week, I will expect a typewritten progress report, together with a breakdown of the running expenses.
You're serious about this, aren't you?
Something awful happened in this room, Blanchard said. I can feel it, even if you can't. Mademoiselle White was frightened and a long way from home. Someone came and killed her, and that isn't right.
I understand, Floyd said.
They had almost reached the door when Blanchard spoke again. There is something I forgot to mention. It might not mean anything, but Mademoiselle White kept an electric typewriter in her room.
He stood with his hand on a large wooden cabinet that was resting on a small bow-legged table.
It was a German model. The name of the firm was Heimsuth and Reinke, I believe. Very heavy. This was the box it came in.
An odd thing for a tourist to carry around with them, Floyd said.
I asked her about it, and all she would say was that she was practicing her touch typing, so that she wouldn't be out of form when she returned home.
You're right to mention it, Floyd said. It's probably not important, but every bit helps.
Perhaps we should look at the typewriter, Christine said.
That's the point, Blanchard replied.
It doesn't exist anymore. The typewriter was found smashed to pieces on the pavement, next to Mademoiselle White.